Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast, and today I want to talk about a topic that's neither light nor entertaining, but very serious and necessary. Today, I'm speaking about suicide and suicide prevention. So before we start, let me fill you in on where the idea for this podcast came from. I have to go back many years when a friend of mine lost her son to suicide. And to me, as a psychologist and a personal friend, I knew the youngster, and it was a case to me of unexplainable, sudden, and unpredictable suicide. In response to their loss, my friend and her husband devoted much of their energy to make sure that this didn't happen to others. They became involved in volunteering for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, or AFSP. And in support of my friend, and in an effort to get the message out there to the public about suicide and suicide prevention, I annually participated in the Out of the Darkness Community Walks. These walks happen all over the country, and you can find out more about them by going to www.afsp.org. As I was at the most recent walk, I heard Dale Kamai, who's also a friend and former colleague, speaking to the crowd of over 1,400 people about trying to get help to get the message out, and it dawned on me that I had the perfect vehicle to help, my podcast. So I invited Dale to be a guest. Now, before we meet Dale, let me give you her background. As I said, she's a friend and a colleague. I met Dale many years ago when we worked together in the Lindbrook School District. At that time, Dale was a special education teacher, and she served as an educational evaluator for 12 years. In 1999, Dale changed career paths following the loss of her best friend's son to suicide. Dale began working in a volunteer capacity for AFSP, and after 5 years, she joined the national field staff. Dale currently serves as the Metro New York Regional Director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And today, she juggles fundraising events, educational programs, AFSPs, survivors, outreach program, and advocacy for suicide prevention. In addition to working for AFSP, Dale was the president of the Long Island Region Women's American ORT. She was one of the founding members of the Lindbrook East Rockaway Democratic Club. Dale was also the founder and president of the South Shore Activists for Choice. She served on the board of the Peninsula Counseling Center and is a member of the Sisterhood at the Hewlett East Rockaway Jewish Center. In 2005, Dale was the recipient of the Long Island Crisis Center's Community Service Award. In addition to her activities, Dale's extremely proud of her 33-year marriage to Stan, her daughter Brooke, who is an attorney in New York City, and her son Jeff, who's attending law school in Georgetown. And now, let's meet Dale. Dale, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thank you, Hallie. Thanks for having me.
I know that you know about the intro and all the great things they said about you, and I wanted to touch on a couple of major issues that need to be addressed in this particular sensitive topic, because we're talking about suicide, and it's clearly an issue that's in every aspect, in every level of our society. So I guess what I want to start off with is, from your knowledge, what do you see as the major risk factors?
There are many, many risk factors that we could look at. The major risk factors, Howie, are psychiatric disorders, such as clinical depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, schizophrenia. That's one of the major risk factors, because the research shows that 90% of the people who die by suicide have a diagnosable psychiatric illness. That doesn't mean that they've all been diagnosed, mm-hmm. but that they do suffer from a diagnosable psychiatric illness. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, there are people who obviously have been in treatment for years and years and years, and it's kind of understandable maybe on some level if someone's been chronically depressed and they've been miserable to see them as a high risk. I guess my concern, what about the people who have not had a history of psychological disorders? Do they represent, as you're saying, a small percentage of the population of those individuals who actually commit suicide?
Yes, there seems to be about 10% of the people who die by suicide where it appears to be somewhat impulsive, and there don't appear to be any symptoms that other people might pick up on or see. And sometimes people work very, very hard and expend a great deal of energy not letting people see those signs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that seems to be an issue because we're not mind readers. We can only see what people show us, or we can hear what they tell us, and then we've got a chance of helping someone. But if people work very hard at hiding what's going on, or in the case of younger adults or adolescents, maybe they don't even know what's happening to them, because that's the time of onset of some of these mental illnesses. And they may not realize that there is a problem, and they don't want to be identified as different from everyone else. They want to fit in. They don't want people to think they're out of the norm. So they try to hide it and don't tell anyone and don't ask for help. And that's when you run into a lot of difficulty and this suicide might occur. And it seems to be spur of the moment. It seems to be very impulsive. You may not think there's any history of psychiatric illness behind it. But again, 90% of the time, there is.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a clinician, when I work with patients who are really, really depressed, I always get worried when they start to get happy.
Yes.
You know, most people would think, well, why would you get worried when they get happy? And sometimes what I find is when they're happy, all of a sudden, out of the blue, nothing really is significantly changed. And all of a sudden they're happy, that I wonder sometimes if, you know, they've made a conscious decision that they're going to end their lives, and therefore their misery and pain is going to end. And so they're kind of ecstatic because they know there's kind of a light for them, or at least they think there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and that's, you know, committing suicide. So I'm always super cautious as a clinician when my patients start to get a little happier for no reason that I could figure.
Right. We talk about when we go out and do visits in schools and things, we talk about actually that exact topic. And what we stress is a little red flag should go up in your head if someone, a friend or a relative, seems to be calmer or more at peace or, as you said, happier, maybe has a little more energy, especially if they haven't gotten any professional help. Mm-hmm. If they're telling you that they're handling issues on their own and they know what they're going to do, and they sort of allude to the fact that they have a plan, then absolutely we feel the same way, that there might be a greater risk that they feel that way because they have decided that suicide is an alternative for them, and they feel more at peace because they know what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
And obviously we don't want suicide to be an alternative for people.
What, from your perspective, are the warning signs that you teach people to look for?
Well, there are a great deal of them. Feelings of sadness. And, you know, we all have bad days or a few bad days strung together, but this is a pervasive feeling of sadness that you don't seem to be able to shake. And it lasts for a week or maybe 2 weeks. But we ask people not to dwell so much on the time factor, because sometimes you wait too long to identify. You say, you know, you feel like you have to give it 2 weeks, and then it may be too late. So it's an unrelenting low mood. It's just a feeling that can't be shaken. You might see mood swings.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's depressed and then sort of manic. And sometimes depression, as you know, Hallie, comes out as more irritability.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always that low feeling, but it's sometimes irritable. So if someone's getting angry, maybe verbally abusive or even physically abusive, you might see a lack of energy. You might also see changes in sleeping and eating patterns. And really the extremes, someone who's sleeping so much that they can't get up to go to school or to go to work, or sleeping so little that they have insomnia and they're up all night pacing, thinking on the computer. And then those people who eat more.
Mm-hmm.
And then people who eat almost nothing.
Right.
People who think about death and suicide, people who have difficulty concentrating, people who might be withdrawing either from social relations or from things that they maybe got pleasure out of, whether it's a sport whether it's sexual activity. There might be an increase in drinking or drug use by people who are almost trying to medicate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to also be some recent research on impulsivity and suicide risk, people who are exhibiting some kind of risk-taking behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all signs that we look for. And then there are really more overt signs, such as talking about suicide, making a plan, giving away some possessions.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I say? Any sudden change in a person's sort of normal behavior or what's normal for them,
mm-hmm,
should be looked at, and you might want to approach that person if you see some changes in their behavior and
right,
talk to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have always told people that I see depression on a scale comparable to an upper respiratory illness. So if you're really, really, really depressed, that's like having pneumonia.
Right.
And when you have pneumonia, you're pretty much out of the count and could potentially be hospitalized because it's that serious. If you have, middle of the road depression, you have the flu. And, you still can't function very well, but it's not to the level that you have to be hospitalized.
Right.
And then there's that low level, what I call subclinical depression, and that's a cold. And
okay,
it's enough to make you feel crappy and make you feel like you really don't function as well as you would like, but you probably still do what you need to do and you get around and you take care of business, but you're just not really up to your game.
Right. You're not operating as you usually do.
Right. And I think there's unfortunately a lot of people out there who I see having this subclinical depression. And that subclinical depression can go into either that, internalization or, turning everything in, or as you described, that blasting out irritability. I've been in restaurants and I've watched people who were horrific, to waiters or waitresses, just nasty and terrible people. And other people look at them and go, what a terrible person. And I look at them and go, ooh, that guy's probably depressed. He just doesn't know it.
That's something we don't often think about. We
mm-hmm.
mostly think that people are just kind of miserable or nasty.
Right.
But you're right. They may be suffering themselves.
Exactly. But that's just a clinical perspective. Anyway, in terms of what we're seeing, I'm assuming that there are, in every field, there are myths and legends and misconceptions and misunderstandings. In the field of suicidology, so to speak, what are the most common myths that you come across?
Oh, there are several. One is really asking a depressed person about suicide will push them to complete
mm-hmm.
the act.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be thought you shouldn't even mention the word because a person might attempt suicide. But studies have shown that people with depression have thought about suicide. You are not putting this idea in their head. And talking about it does not increase the risk. As a matter of fact, if you talk to someone, they may, if they're willing to open up and let you in, they may actually be relieved that you've said the word, that you're willing to talk about the subject, broach this subject with them,
mm-hmm.
and this may be the first opportunity, that they've had to speak about it. So that's a very common myth.
That's been around for a long, long time. And you're right. I've tried to work with a lot of people about that, regarding talking to their kids about it, because they're always afraid that somehow they're going to put a thought in their head that wasn't there.
Exactly.
But the reality is, you're right. It's generally, if someone's very depressed, it's something that they've thought about. So
absolutely,
it's not something that you're planting. You didn't give that child, an adolescent, an idea that didn't occur to them before.
Right. There's a few others. One is that suicidal people are fully intent on dying.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really not true. The research shows that most people who are suicidal are really quite ambivalent about living or dying. They really just want to end the emotional pain that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're suffering from a psychiatric illness like depression, they may not see any alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And so this seems like a way to end the pain. And I'm, you know, if you've never suffered from clinical depression, you can't understand it, but I'm told that it's like being in a dark, deep, black hole where you can't even see the light. You don't see any way out.
Mm-hmm.
And so suicide seems like a way to end the emotional pain.
Yeah, that's my patients basically also say that it's their lives are so painful that this seems to be the only path that they see as a viable choice. And they get what we call tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they see. And they don't see that there are other options. And so as a clinician, our job really is to provide them with other avenues and other approaches and other problem-solving techniques to get them through. And then once you get them through that particular issue, you hope that they start to learn that there are alternative ways to fix their lives' problems and not necessarily pick this one fatal path.
Exactly, because suicide is a permanent solution
mm-hmm.
to hopefully temporary problems.
And the other thing that I always find, when people are in that kind of suicide mode, I find that they get very selfish. And they think only of their own pain. And I've always tried to get them to look at, what is the wake of disaster that you leave behind you? Do you understand how everyone around you, who cares for you, is going to feel when this happens, and they couldn't stop you, or they couldn't prevent it, and they're going to feel guilty and horrible and terrible and remorseful and upset? Can you think about what that does to them? And I do that in an effort to kind of get them out of their own skin, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, but that's what I was going to ask. Are people able to see that?
Sometimes they can, and sometimes they'll say stuff like, well, they'll get over it. They'll get past
it. I've heard people say, sometimes my family will be better off without me. They feel like a burden
mm-hmm.
or a disappointment. And that could really be just that one person's reality, their perception of reality, when in truth, you know, the family doesn't see them in that light. But that may be how they view it.
Right, because that's how they view themselves. You know, what I tell people generally is, you know, you look at the world through your own eyes and you assume that everyone else perceives the world the same way you do.
Exactly.
And it's not true. And
that's
so
exactly.
These people, right, they're in such a deep funk that they think they're just horrible, terrible people. You know, sometimes what I've been able to do is get family members to come in and actually talk about how they feel about this individual. And that sometimes breaks down this "I'm a terrible, horrible person" perception, because they hear it for the first time. What I find is when people are emotionally distraught, they become terrible reality testers. They perceive life in their own narrow way, and
right.
they don't know how to really, you know, check or validate what they are perceiving. And, you know, you always have to get them to go out of their own skin and say, and I say, ask someone, why don't we find someone who you trust? And let's ask them if they see it the same way. And I would say 100% of the time, they're shocked that people don't see it their way.
That's a good strategy, though. I like that. And the other myth that I just wanted to tell you about was, people seem to think that somehow a bad event can push a person to complete suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, the way it's reported in the media, it kind of appears that way.
Right.
A bad breakup, loss of a job, things that happen. But the truth of the matter, the fact behind that is that, again, suicide results from serious psychiatric disorders, not just a single event
mm-hmm.
in a person's life. So I think that's important.
So, Dale, how would someone talk to a friend who might be in trouble?
I think the most important thing is to ask directly. If you think that there's someone in your life who is in a crisis and who might be feeling that they are looking at suicide as an alternative, two of the most important things are to let the person know you care.
Mm-hmm.
Be empathetic. Let them know you care about them. See if they will talk to you, open up about what's going on in their lives. See if they'll talk about their feelings. Then you should reflect what you're hearing them say. And ask, ask if they're planning to hurt themselves in whatever language is comfortable for the person doing the asking. Are you planning to hurt yourself? Do you feel suicidal? Have you thought about taking your life? And if they say yes, some people will say, absolutely not, there's nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could let them know you're there for them should they want to speak
mm-hmm.
at any time. But if they do say, yes, I have thought about this, then you should go on and ask them if they have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have a plan, you should go even a little further and say something to the effect of, have you thought about a time frame? And if they say yes, the more detailed their answer, the more concerned you need to be that there is an immediate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then we tell people not to leave that person alone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you need to bring in whatever help you can. It may be, if we're talking to an audience of kids, you know, young people, we say, ask the person if there's someone they trust. Ask for permission to bring someone in, either a teacher, a parent, a doctor, someone that you trust in the school or in your family, and get them to come in and help you, especially if you're a young person who's, you know, a preteen or a teen who doesn't drive, because you might need to get the person to a therapist or to a hospital. And if all else fails, you can call 911 if you think that there's an immediate crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically tell people, you know, not to offer an immediate fix. Don't tell people, oh, everything will be fine tomorrow, because it might not be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, don't minimize it.
Right. You want to be as realistic as possible. Don't make false promises. Oh, you know, sleep on it. Things will be better in the morning. Because there are issues going on that it might take weeks or months to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is, as you know, Hallie, there is help out there and there is hope. And illnesses like depression are treatable.
Right. I want to remind the audience I'm talking to Dale Kamhai, who currently serves as the Metro New York Regional Director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Dale, what does the AFSP do? I mean, what is their function?
Well, AFSP has several functions. Let me tell you what we are not. We are not a counseling center, and we don't provide hands-on services, okay? What we do is raise funds for research and educational programs and survivor initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
We give out about $2 million or close to $2 million in research grants
mm-hmm.
per year, and we have a scientific council that evaluates these grants and figures out how much they receive and who gets them. We also produce educational programs, and we've got several really phenomenal programs, Hallie. We've got a film that's geared for college students called The Truth About Suicide, Real
mm-hmm.
Stories of Depression in College. We've been using this film for a number of years. It's being used throughout the country to be shown to resident assistants on college campuses, students themselves. Sometimes it's used as freshman orientation, because we talk about safe sex, we talk about drugs and alcohol, but we don't often talk about stress and the issue of suicide and mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got that going. We also have produced in the past year two videos called More Than Sad, and these are for middle and high school students. There's one DVD for students and one for teachers, staff, and administrators, and we're using that right now all around the country, going to high schools and providing educational programs at the schools. We sponsor a National Survivors of Suicide Day broadcast once a year. There's an annual conference, always the Saturday before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
There are over 200 sites across the country where these are provided. It's a broadcast, a DVD broadcast, and some of the sites have breakout groups
mm-hmm.
following that. We have a survivor outreach program for survivors of suicide loss. That's anybody who's lost a friend or loved one to suicide. We have specially trained volunteers who are survivors. They are not mental health professionals. They are people who've lost someone to suicide. They are ready, willing, and able to go out and make home visits if requested by a family. We provide facilitator training for those people who'd like to learn how to run a support group. We're also, the Long Island chapter is also co-sponsoring a conference with the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Long Island. It's a one-day conference. We've been doing it for about 4 years. And we have speakers and breakout group workshops, and that's something that we do locally. So we've got a lot of education. We're also branching into a new field on advocacy. So we're recruiting, training, and supporting volunteers to be advocates for suicide prevention in all 50 states. And that's
a lot.
That's a lot of what we're doing.
A lot of stuff. Yeah. Not to mention the walks all over the country, right?
Yes. Every fall we do walks. We have, again, over 250 sites. 7 years ago we had 24 walks, and now we're up to over 250. And the walks take place every fall. And they're really amazing. The walks are going to raise over $5 million this year for AFSP and suicide prevention.
That's terrific.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, unfortunately, Dale, we're out of time. I hope you enjoyed doing this podcast with me.
I absolutely did.
And I hope the audience learned something and got some information that will prove to be useful, because this is a significant problem that needs to be addressed, and we have to keep it out in the public, you know.
We have to talk about it,
right?
And reduce the stigma around mental illness so that more people will seek treatment and we won't lose as many people as we do to suicide.
Exactly. And for my audience's sake, they could find out more information about the walks at www.outofthedarkness.org. Or if they want to find out more information about the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, they can go to www.afsp.org.
Till next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.